Oh, what's that smell? Oh, it must be scat.
When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast where we discuss the famous and infamous comic book runs and story arcs throughout the history of the medium. I'm Paul Matthew Carr, and with me, as always, is the one and only Brian K. Reese.
That's me. Hey, Paul.
You get to talk now. So how are you, Brian?
I am fantastic today, Paul. The force is with me today.
Oh, good. That's fantastic. I wasn't expecting.
I feel it flowing through my body.
It could just be the caffeine.
It could.
Yes.
But I prefer to say that it's the force.
Very good. Okay, today on the program, we'll be discussing the celebrated run of Brian Azzarello's Wonder Woman. But before we do, the San Diego Comic-Con was this week. Now, many things were announced, but there was one thing that immediately struck me, and that was the announcement of the Flashpoint live-action movie. So I ask you, Brian.
Ask me.
Is DC rebooting their cinematic universe?
I don't know. I don't. Does anyone truly know what DC is doing in their cinematic universe? I mean, that's the big question. But the announcement of Flashpoint, and again, the information is pretty sketchy on it.
There's not very much released,
right? So, and I know that some folks are all a Twitter that it's a reboot of some sort, as based on the Flashpoint comic that led into the New 52, which was, for all intents, it was a reboot, even though they resisted calling it a reboot.
It was a reboot.
It was a reboot, yeah. Yes. So, are they just using it as a story, or are they using it as a new jumping off point? I don't know. It seems to make sense that they would be looking at a new jumping off point for their cinematic universe because of how poorly much of what has come in the last few years has been received, Wonder Woman accepted.
Yeah, the Snyderverse did not go very well.
The Snyderverse did not go very well. We don't know Justice League yet. There's been positive talk about it. There's been negative talk about it. You know, if it's good, everybody's going to say it's,
Whedon.
And if it's bad, then they'll blame it on Snyder. It's kind of a lose-lose or win-win situation for each of those two individuals.
Yeah. And you know, all credit to Whedon. He's been saying he's just the caretaker. It's really Snyder's movie. And,
right.
You know, so, you know, honorable of him.
But I believe that Steven Spielberg also said he was just the caretaker of AI.
That
didn't turn out so well.
True. But the intriguing thing to me is that, well, a lot of signs, the hiring of Whedon, for instance,
mm-hmm.
The how well Wonder Woman has been received.
Deservedly so.
And then the news this week that they're thinking of replacing Ben Affleck. I don't know if you heard that.
Yeah, I saw, Jeffrey Dean Morgan, there was some discussion with him. I almost called him Harry Dean Stanton. I don't know why, but...
I would love Harry Dean Stanton.
I would love a Harry Dean Stanton Batman. that would be, can someone make this happen? To the powerful people out there who are listening to this, please make this happen.
Well, and if you're doing Harry Dean Stanton as Batman, let's do Kyle MacLachlan as Robin.
Of course.
Yeah. And then directed by David Lynch. There we go.
That is a Batman movie for the ages.
Yes. Twin Peaks Gotham.
Yeah.
But anyway, back to the subject at hand. It seems like a natural thing to do that. Okay, let's take all the good stuff that we like.
Right.
And we'll keep that, but then we can do a flashpoint and reset everything, including a couple of actors, if we so choose.
Yes.
It makes a lot of sense to do Flashpoint as a reboot of the universe. And it won't hurt continuity. It'll actually enhance things going forward.
And it's not like continuity really matters in the DC films at this point.
They haven't really cared about it.
Yes, anyway. Yeah. My only sort of halting point on this would be some concern. Are they actually going to use the Flashpoint series, the Flashpoint miniseries? Do people say miniseries? Are we allowed to say miniseries anymore?
Well, it's a crossover event.
Yes, it is a crossover event. There, thank you. limited series, that's right.
Limited series.
Yeah. If they're using that particular story as is, I can see some problems coming into play. I mean, you know, it's Thomas Wayne as Batman with Bruce Wayne being killed. I just don't see how that works if you're building...
I think you could use Affleck as Thomas Wayne in the Flashpoint universe, and then that opens up a new Batman to be a new actor to play Batman. So it's a way to keep, you know, so Affleck's been in a couple of films now.
Right.
And then you just kind of shift his role to the father. Because what they're saying is he might be a little bit too old to do a Batman trilogy now. It's like, well, why didn't you think about that when you cast him in the first place?
Well, how old is Jeffrey Dean Morgan?
I don't think they're going to do Jeffrey Dean Morgan. I think they're going to cast young.
Okay.
Yeah, that's my...
I think I'm getting stuck on the Jeffrey Dean Morgan thing, and that's probably...
No, because Jeffrey Dean Morgan...
Because of rumors, and rumors of rumors.
Yeah, so I just think that they're going to cast him young, you know, someone in their 20s.
And I guess, if they're presenting it as some sort of Elseworlds, but if they really are rebooting into the Flashpoint universe, and if we really are going to be returning to the DC world of the New 52, that's weird. It's just a little weird. Now, if they're going to use Flashpoint from the Flash series...
The TV series, you mean?
Yeah, the Flash TV series. That is a little more intriguing.
I think that's what the way they would do it. The same way that Marvel used Civil War to tell a completely different story. They did not tell the Civil War storyline, thank God, because that was a hot mess. You know, but they just used the elements that were kind of worked for the current universe.
Right.
I think that DC would probably do the same thing. Just use Flashpoint as first of all, it's a good story for Flash to be running around and seeing alternate versions of these people.
Sure. And, you know, it's fun, but it works more as, like I said, it works more to me as an Elseworlds, like, because we didn't know at the time how bad the New 52 was going to be, with some exceptions, but...
No, but they could just use it as a jumping off point to kind of reset their universe. The biggest problem with...
Which it does need to be reset. Absolutely, you know, acquiesce to that point.
The biggest part of the DC cinematic universe or extended, what is it? DCEU or something like that.
Right.
First of all, they made it dark and gritty, which, you know, it's fine for a one-off, but you can't make an entire universe dark and gritty because it's not fun. And you box yourself into a certain type of storytelling.
Sure.
And they didn't establish the individual characters first. I mean, yes, I know these are iconic characters, but they're not established in the filmgoer's mind yet. You know, and I know they wanted to differentiate themselves from the Marvel model, because that's what Marvel did.
Right, and yeah, if they're just copying, then that doesn't get us anywhere where we want to be.
But the MCU is successful for a reason. They did things in a correct order.
Well, they thought it through.
Yes.
And they had a plan.
That, right there, they thought it through.
Yeah.
and that is something that I don't think, you know, the DC film... You know, I'm talking specifically the films here.
Right, yeah, because the comics now, like, it's the opposite with both companies in the comics world right now.
Absolutely. Yeah, that just seems like they didn't have a plan. They just wanted to rush through, let's get Superman fighting Batman. It was as if someone had all their action figures and just sort of shoved them together.
Well, and I think Time Warner, you know, the reason they own DC and the reason they hold on to DC isn't for the comics. It's for the property.
Right.
You know, and so I think Time Warner just, they thought they could just throw Batman out there or throw Superman out there or throw whoever out there. And it would be like, oh, see, this is a property that is valued. Oh, it's Superman. Everybody knows Superman. So we don't have to think things through in a reasonable manner and create a cohesive universe where we could plug into films going forward.
I mean, yeah, they didn't trust the intelligence of their fan base. Oh, the nerds will like this. It's just Superman fighting Batman. The nerds will be all over it. Like, you know what? We actually like good storytelling.
Well, and we've seen Superman fighting Batman over and over and over and over again. You know, so it's not, like you said, not just good storytelling, but unique storytelling, original storytelling, which I know is very hard to do with the capes because it feels like every story that could be told has already been told. But I don't necessarily believe that.
And no.
If you put the creative people behind it, like, say, a Grant Morrison or what have you, you get fascinating stories.
Yeah, we're already seeing that in multiple. My personal theory is that the superhero movie is the new Western.
Sure.
So, you know, Westerns have their particular setup and their particular tropes, but tons of different kinds of stories can be told within that genre.
Right.
And what we're seeing right now is that superhero stories can tell all kinds of different stories. I mean, look at Logan just this year. Mm-hmm. Told a very different story from, say, Spider-Man that just came out, right, or Wonder Woman. You know, we got a World War II-centric superhero film, a modern New York, you know, Queens teenager, you know, kind of a, you know, like a Breakfast Club, you know, John Hughes is the name I was looking
for. Yeah.
Like a John Hughes type of film. And then Logan, which is just a horribly depressing take on, you know, old age and Alzheimer's. I mean, no, it's true. It's exactly what the themes were. And it's amazing what the genre can do if given creative people with enough freedom to see that vision through.
The question, though, also arises, though, this is the rough part, is in some ways the comic world is trapped with the type of storytelling it can do, partly because of the audience, because you can't get too creative because then people aren't going to go. And I know that sounds incredibly cynical of me, but how many Transformers films have we had?
Those are terrible films, though.
But the masses go. You know, it's people. You know, how many Fast and Furious and Transformers films have we seen where it's the same plot over and over and over again, and things blow up real good? It's and yet the public has told the studios at some point that they want to see the same things over and over again. So I think that there is a trap, and I think that is partly why there is caution sometimes from the studio heads, and particularly even from the DC and Marvel film universes, is, you know, if you make something too challenging, will it destroy the franchise? I realize that is an incredibly cynical take from me.
Yeah, it is. And I disagree with that. I think that you're not giving the film-going audience enough credit, because you can have substance. I believe that the filmgoers, for the most part, agree with substance over spectacle. And that's why you see all the Transformers films, yeah, they all made bank, but always decreasing over time. And to this last one, everyone's fed up with it. Nope, don't want to see that again. You know, Suicide Squad and Batman v Superman made their money back. They made money, but
they made a lot of money.
Yeah, but audiences don't like it. They go for the spectacle, but it doesn't continue. Whereas something like Wonder Woman had a huge opening weekend, but then a huge following weekend and a weekend after that.
I think it's still going strong.
I think, yeah, exactly.
I don't know the numbers right now, but you know, it's
people respond to quality. You know, all of those movies will make $1 billion in the first couple of weeks because people will go for the spectacle. But you know, but if something's good, they're gonna, you know, Logan made a lot of money, but it made it over time because word of mouth said, this is a good film, you should go see it. And I think that's the type of movie that more people will gravitate to. We got to stop thinking about in terms of opening weekend.
Yeah, I mean, that'd be nice, but conversely, has Moonlight made $1 million yet?
That's never going to make $1 million.
You know,
that's not the same type of thing.
It's not a superhero movie. Yeah, it's not a popcorn film. But
yeah, and that's that's not a film that people are going to go to multiple times either.
But you know, do people go for quality? Or who knows? Anyway, maybe that was a poor example. I don't think it was, but you can make a case that it was.
Okay. I just think that's an apples and oranges thing there. We're talking about, you know, summer tentpole films and quiet indie contemplative films.
Right.
Two totally different things, and they shouldn't be judged the same.
And nothing blew up real good in it.
Except maybe the Oscars. Oh!
No!
So I actually think this is really intriguing, and it actually gives me hope for the DC universe. Because a few episodes back, I talked about, I just want to see a good Superman film.
Yeah.
Just want to see, people are going to give me shit for the you know, yes, the original Superman films with Christopher Reeve, they were fun, but they were not campy. Very good. Yeah. They were campy. And it's fine. They're very fun as a campy take. It's fine.
They're still fun. Some of them are still fun to watch even now. If I'm flipping through the TV and I'm like, oh, Superman 1, 2, or 3 are on, I'll probably stop and watch it. Maybe not the whole thing, but, you know.
Yeah, I own them. I have them on DVD on my shelf, and I still do pop in 1 and 2 every once in a while. You know, in the same way that I watch the old 60s Batman, because it's fun.
It is fun.
But wouldn't you like to see a serious take, not a gritty deconstruction, but a serious take on the idea of Superman. You know, really get into what makes this character unique and special. Right. Not try to turn him into a villain or deconstruct his motives. Just tell a story about a very good person conflicted about not being able to help everyone at the same, you know, all the time.
Right.
That's what makes,
Writers have always had, Superman has always been a hard character to write. Very few people have done it really well, which is amazing that he has, you know, the longevity that Superman has had as an iconic figure is sometimes belied by some of the quality of the actual comics that have, and now there are great, great Superman stories out there. All-Star Superman.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's the type of story that I would like to see. That's exactly what I want to see on film, on the screen.
Right.
You know, and you know, this speaks to not many people trust. Grant Morrison got it. Grant Morrison understood the nature of that character.
Right.
And what makes it so unique and compelling and why he's such an iconic character. Right. There's so many writers out there who don't trust that.
Yeah.
Or, you know, what's the biggest complaint about Superman? Oh, he's overpowered and he's boring.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's like, what do you do with a guy who can't be killed? Well, we know he can be killed, but you know, it's like, it takes a lot of work.
Yeah. But that's, you know, trust the concept, you know, what makes, you know, yes, he's wholesome and good. It's the same thing with Captain America. You know, people don't trust the fact that a genuinely good person can be compelling.
Right.
You know, so they have to make him flawed. Yeah.
They have to make him a Nazi.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. He's not a Nazi. Not a Nazi. Can you see the air quotes?
No, I couldn't. But yes, he's a Nazi and it's stupid.
Yeah. But back to film, you know, I think with Flashpoint, like all of these points, I think are relevant to, you know, your initial thought about Flashpoint. And if Flashpoint can indeed reboot and they can get an interesting writers and interesting creators in there on the film side who can do something interesting with Superman, you know, in all of the ways that you just spoke about, that would be amazing. And it would be certainly something to be excited about.
Yes. I mean, and it can be done. They just did it with Wonder Woman.
Yes.
You know, the general take on Wonder Woman is that she's a fish out of water and she's naive. Well, that's not the characterization in this movie. Yes, she doesn't understand things, but she's smart and confident and a badass and is able to just take charge. That was a perfect take on that character.
Right. And Nolan's Batman. Interesting things with a character that some people have been feeling lately you can't do interesting things with. I don't agree with them, but, you know, they're in the same way with Superman. But Nolan definitely took a very unique tact with Batman.
Yes.
It worked, both, as you said, commercially and critically.
Yeah. And, yes, Nolan's films are great in and of themselves. But wouldn't you like to see, because how many, whether it be the Tim Burton, Schumacher, or Snyder, they always got to put a gun in Batman's hand and make him a, you know, psychopath, basically.
Right.
And, you know, because he's more compelling that way. No. This is the same way. He's conflicted, but there's much more to the character of Batman that we have not seen on film yet.
Yes.
You know, Nolan's films are great, but they are essentially a deconstruction, a gritty deconstruction of that character. Wouldn't you just rather see a straightforward depiction of what Batman is in the comics? I mean, the Tom King run right now.
Right.
Is brilliant. He's a genuinely decent man who's conflicted about his actions maybe hurting other people. That's all.
And I think one of the other things I that, you know, using Flashpoint as a reboot for the DC Cinematic Universe is, I mean, what are some of the other projects? We have Cyborg, right, is coming up. There's Shazam.
Which is just fascinating.
I love it. I mean, I
think it's great.
And I would like, I kind of hope they do something fun with those. I mean, they're taking what are kind of B-list characters, and, you know, in the same way that Marvel did with Guardians and did with Ant-Man, you know, I like the fact that they have some stuff in the pipeline that isn't just the Trinity or even the Green Lanterns or the Flashes. I think we do have a Flash coming up as well, but.
Well, they're going to do not Aquaman. They're going to do not just a Green Lantern, but a Green Lantern Corps. So that that could be very Guardians of the Galaxy, you know, not Ryan Reynolds in an animated suit somewhere out in space and doing kind of crazy, wacky stuff. I think that's a great thing to do.
Although I demand a Ryan Reynolds cameo in it.
No, but if they do a dark and gritty reboot of Shazam, I'm done. I'm off. I'm out of here. Check, please. No, that should be bright and colorful and ecstatically happy.
And we got to have the tiger.
Yes, everything. Yeah. Oh, throw in the whole Marvel family, you know, the Captain Marvel family. Because wasn't there a father with a big beer belly?
Yeah, I forget what it my memory is a little cutty, is a little Swiss cheesy right now. But yes, there was the grandpa.
And there was Ms. or Mrs. Marvel or Marvel Girl. I don't know. They all run together.
But I think most important of all with Flashpoint is if we can get a Captain Carrot.
Yeah. I am unfamiliar with Captain Carrot.
Okay.
All right.
Well, now you have a homework project.
Should I read 24 of them? Be a 24 carat. So, Flashpoint. To sum up, I think that's a fantastic opportunity to get back on track and start making the DC universe fun again.
And I am cautiously optimistic, and I will give it a 7 out of 10.
Okay.
All right, let's move on to Wonder Woman, but first, let's take a quick break.
Hey there, do you like Man Thing? You know I do. In fact, there is nothing I like more than getting my hands on a giant-sized Man Thing. It just makes me feel so good. Wait, you know I'm talking about the comic book character, right? Of course you do. How could you be thinking anything else? Man Thing was created in the early 1970s to capitalize on the growing monster craze, but under writer Steve Gerber, it became something quite different. Experimental, surreal, and very, very weird. It was something I loved as a kid, but does it still hold up today, 4 decades after its initial publication? So join me, Paul Matthew Carr, as I attempt to make sense of this cult classic and analyze each issue, putting it in the context of the time it was written and comparing it to the standards of today. And maybe you too can come to love the world's second most famous swamp-based comic book character as much as I do. The Nexus of All Realities, a Man-Thing podcast, a twice-monthly dive into the bizarre. Oh, and I'll probably make some penis jokes.
After the Flashpoint crossover event, DC did a company-wide reboot with the launch of the New 52. This allowed for old storylines to be condensed, made more timely, or simply jettisoned completely. This also allowed for the creation of new or revised origin stories. Now, the success of this retooling was, let's say, varied. As was the response from critics and fans. The one reboot that received near universal praise, however, was Brian Azzarello's reimagining of Wonder Woman. Today we'll be discussing the first volume of that run, entitled Blood. This comprised of issues 1 through 6 that originally ran from November 2011 to April 2012. It was written by Brian Azzarello, with art by Cliff Chang for the first 4 issues and Troy Aikens for the final 2. We begin with various Greek gods attempting to kill a pregnant woman named Zola. With the help of Hermes, Zola is transported to the protection of Diana, Wonder Woman. It turns out that Zola's baby was fathered by Zeus, and is prophesied one day to take the throne of Olympus, if it lives, of course. And with Zeus dead, the other children of Zeus see that as an obstacle. Wanting to protect Zola, Wonder Woman has Hermes take the trio to Themyscira, or Paradise Island, the home of the Amazons, where Diana was born and raised. There we learn of her unique birth, being molded from clay and given the breath of life by her mother. But with the arrival of Strife, that's the god Strife, with a capital S, she learns the real story. Diana was actually fathered by Zeus, and that fact was hidden by her mother so as to save her from being killed by Hera, the wife of Zeus, who tends to be a bit put out by all the infidelity and shenanigans by her, let's face it, douchebag husband. Diana is not pleased by this revelation. She leaves Paradise Island with Zola and Hermes in tow to brood a bit in a bar. You know, like you do when you find out you're a demigod rather than a sentient piece of clay. I hate it when that happens. In the meantime, Hera finds out the Amazon's deception and deals with this by turning them all into snakes. Except for Diana's mother, of course, she gets turned to stone. Hera, she seems nice. Back in London, a distraught Diana and Zola do a bit of bonding, and they meet Lennox, also an illegitimate child of Zeus, made of living stone. Together, they hatch a plan. With the absence of Zeus, the throne is up for grabs, and Poseidon and Hades plan to claim it. Lennox and Wonder Woman convince them, however, that it is Hera who plans to take the throne. But they could get around this by sharing the throne and both taking Hera as a queen. If this sounds convoluted, go read some Greek mythology. It makes perfect sense. Hera, as you can imagine, is not gung-ho for this plan, but while they argue, Lennox steals a candle from Hades and the staff of Hermes, and with them they are able to bind Hera so that she can't hurt Zola or anyone else for that matter. And the succession thing was all a ruse. Feeling they've been played, Poseidon and Hades sulk off, but Hades steals Zola out of spite, leaving Wonder Woman to ponder her next move.
So the only, here's what I'll add is, I don't think Poseidon sulked off. He seemed to be very amused by the whole thing.
That's true. He did seem rather, rather
Hades
pleased.
Hades was very put out.
Yes. Well, you know, the god of the underworld and everything tend to brood.
Well, Poseidon actually kind of gave them a well done. Cheerio, good fellows, with some wah-ha-ha-ha's to go along.
Yes, there were some wah-ha-ha's in there, as a matter of fact.
Literally.
Now, I have not read this before. I did not read this before recommending it. Wonder Woman had never been someone that I read other than a few comics here and there, you know, the Perez run, Silver Age stuff. With the movie coming out, I wanted to learn more and to read more and, you know, to learn more about one of the most iconic characters in all of comics.
So to clarify, you're saying that you had not read this before recommending it.
Exactly.
Nice. I applaud that, and I think that that is something going forward that maybe we both should strive for.
Yeah. Part of this, you know, part of what I want from this show is to be exposed to different things that I haven't read yet and maybe get to stuff that I planned on reading but, you know, have never gotten around to. If nothing else, it's an excuse for me to read more, which is nice. So overall, you know, the reason I wanted to read this one is because it's gotten near universal praise. Not everyone liked it. But overall, I was very impressed by this. Yeah, it's a very compelling story. It's a quick read, but there's a lot going on.
Yeah. It's that weird sort of, it's not the like sort of decompressed nature that you see in some certain writers who I will not mention, but it also is, it's kind of like the classic tradition of, it's a relatively quick read. A lot happens within that quick read. So when you're finished with it, you don't feel when you've read that individual issue that you have been ripped off.
No. I think I shouldn't really say it's a quick read. It's more, there's an economy of story.
Right.
You know,
and I think that's something that Azzarello does very well.
Yeah. There's not a lot of padding. This is the story. This is what's going on. And he gets right to it.
And there are sort of extensive panels of dialogue, but all those dialogue, even if they don't work towards the plot, they work towards the character, which is equally as important.
Yes. That's something I think he did incredibly well.
Yes.
Is he's able to build these, I mean, because we sort of know Wonder Woman already. But he's adding Zola and Lennox and Hermes and Hera and all, you know, the entire pantheon of gods. Yeah. And he's giving each one a character, and
get a unique voice and a unique persona that sometimes is missing in a lot of comics, where you feel like each character is sort of like, if a writer isn't very good, all the characters sound the same. And I think like what Azzarello does is he does these sort of long panels of people talking, but the whole point of it is to differentiate each character from the other.
Yes. He gives everyone a unique personality.
Yeah.
In a very short amount of time. It's very impressive. I'm sorry, I cut you off there.
Oh, sorry. I just said, and humor. There's a lot of humor.
Yes, there is.
There's a lot of humor in this among some very serious themes.
Yeah. And, you know, the artwork, there's a lot of humor, but the artwork is fairly dark as far as tone is concerned. It's a very unique style. that I like a lot.
Well, Cliff Chang, and I think we both acknowledge that we may be mispronouncing.
Yes. If so,
our apologies to the artist, who I'm sure is listening.
Yes, it's my superpower. I can mispronounce someone's name immediately.
But, I mean, it's such a minimalist style.
Yes.
With so much going on within the minimalism. I mean, you know, backgrounds are kind of basic, but they also build sort of a tone. And I think he does faces very well, especially the fact that War, who I'm sure we will speak about, is actually, I believe, if I'm not sure this is apocryphal or not, but I've seen Brian Azzarello. I'm pretty sure War is an exact copy of Brian Azzarello.
Oh, you know what? I hadn't even thought of that. But now that you mention it, yes, he looks exactly like Brian Azzarello.
Yeah.
It's so obvious now that you mention it. But
there might be a couple inches difference in the beard.
That's great.
Yeah. Right. And it is, but that's, I think, the genius of the art is, I don't think that was Azzarello's choice, but clearly he was fine with that going forward, which is kind of amusing. But I think, like, sort of there's kind of a blocky style to the art, but it fits within, like, sort of the thematic nature of how Azzarello is trying to present the characters.
Yeah, absolutely. It's hyper-stylized. But that works well, I mean, incredibly well for the mythological idea of it. Mm-hmm. It's almost like these characters are painted on the side of a vase.
Yeah. Now I think Akins, who is the common fill-in on art, yeah. And he did the last two issues of this, did a very good job of aping Chang's art while not just being a clone of Chang's art. And I think he kept the tone to the comic very well.
Yes, yes. Yeah, he kept the style, but there's still flourishes of his own.
Right.
His own style in there.
Yes.
So where should we begin? Should we, would you like to talk about the controversy? I'm using air quotes, but you can't see that because this is an audio.
Is this the part we're cutting out?
No, we can do it. No, it's, you know, it all depends.
Well, I mean, I think it's fair to address, like, what I think is some legitimate concerns, in terms of how, at least when we have our six issues, I think it's fair to address why some folks were not overly enthused by this particular reading of Wonder Woman, particularly in the aspect of her having been clay, which is a very important thematic issue, and now is the product of a male, which
is very
controversial within Wonder Woman lore.
Yes. Well, I'll paraphrase. I don't have the exact quote in front of you, so I'm going to paraphrase Gail Simone, who said that essentially that by making Zeus the father and focusing on the masculine, it takes away from the femininity of the character. And I can see that.
A completely legitimate concern, and one that I think has been addressed in recent runs by Greg Rucka.
I know, and Wonder Woman is a feminist character, even though, or actually in spite of being written mostly by men. But I don't think
The unfortunate part is, like, I love Gail Simone, but her run on Wonder Woman was not particularly one of the more heralded runs on Wonder Woman.
Yeah, see, I can't speak to that because I haven't read that run. So
it seemed like she should have been a natural fit. And it seemed like when she was announced, this was years ago, as the writer of Wonder Woman, everybody rejoiced because it was like, wow, I mean, this is perfect.
You know, yeah. Well, she's one of my favorite creators.
Right, you have one of the great writers in comics taking over a character that I think most people felt for years should have been written by Gail Simone.
Absolutely.
Or someone like Gail Simone. But Gail Simone is so great in so many ways that you would have thought that it would have been match made in heaven. And
I find that incredibly surprising that it's not a good run. You know, that's actually in my queue for things to read in the future. But I don't think, I mean, and to be fair to Gail Simone, she has said, you know, on Twitter and so forth, that she really enjoyed Brian Ezra, this run, but that she just had some philosophical problems with it.
Sure.
Yeah. But I don't think that Azzarello did this, you know, spitefully or intentionally. You know, I don't think he wanted to remove the feminist aspects of her origin, but the story he was telling, he just wanted to tie it more closely to Greek mythology and to make her a member, an active participant in the pantheon.
Right. And it almost, for it to be the story he wanted to tell, it had to feed the story that this is how it went.
Yeah, unfortunately, to do that, you have to lean real heavy on Zeus and the masculine aspects of that mythology. That's, you know, that's what Greek mythology is. It's very, very hyper-masculine.
Right.
So, I think in order to tie it to that, you know, tie it to it, the Greek origins, unfortunately, it kind of pushed it towards the masculine source. It is, they do follow the father quite a bit in this.
Right.
And I don't want to say that that Wonder Woman's mother was fridged.
But, ooh.
Well, yeah. She's turned to stone and removed from the story.
Yeah.
Which pushes her towards, you know, pushes her towards wanting revenge and redemption.
Again, the removal of the female to further a plot that is largely male in nature is always a very, very, very tricky. Well, it's not even tricky. In some cases, it's just downright wrong.
Yeah. But Diana, Wonder Woman, in this story is very feminine but strong, and you know, she's a great character. It doesn't, you know, I don't know how to phrase exactly what I'm, you know, what's in my head right now. You know what I'm trying to get at, though.
Yes.
She's an incredibly strong character in and of herself. And it's not because she's the child of Zeus that makes her strong. She's that strong person because of the Amazons, because of the female aspect.
Right.
So I think I see what people have gotten. I see the point people have made. I understand that. But, you know, it's something I didn't notice when I first read through this, and maybe that says a lot about me.
Well, I mean, we all bring our own we bring our own experiences into our readings, mm-hmm. and it's very difficult to remove our own experiences from our readings. And you know, the important thing is bringing our own experience to the reading, and then finding out other people's experience in the reading, and saying that is an interesting take on it, and saying, mm-hmm. you know, wow, I never thought about that before. And what that does is that opens up an ability to read things in a different way. So, and that's a good thing. It's a good thing to basically find a different viewpoint and find out how that viewpoint plays into that which we are bringing our own viewpoint into.
Yeah. And I think all those different viewpoints actually enhance the story. Makes you think about it in different ways. So. Yeah.
So, but I think for our purposes here, I mean, the piece is what it is.
Yes.
And so what we want to do is take it as the piece that it is. Is this a well-written piece? Is this good comics?
I would have to say undoubtedly, yes.
And I think so as well. I think it's very good comics from a story standpoint.
Yes.
And definitely from an art standpoint.
Yes. But from a story standpoint, I mean, first of all, I really like the fact that Azzarello, you know, rather than taking the character and having them do straight up superheroing, he opts for mythological intrigue.
There are almost no superhero tropes. Even Wonder Woman herself, Diana, does not act as a superhero.
No, she acts as a defender or protector.
Right.
Which is, you know, that in and of itself is intriguing. She's a protector. She holds everything close. She's not actively going out and squashing evil.
Right.
She's keeping people safe, which I think that's a fantastic angle to take.
Well, and she's not just keeping people safe, but she is actively participating within as we go forward in the series, she's actively participating in sort of the nature of hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And is actively opposing some of the hierarchical nature of the gods, and particularly because this is all Greek mythology. This is one of the great things about this, is that I think Azzarello was given basically carte blanche. It doesn't seem like he had any editorial dictates put upon him. And it's one of the rare comics in the New 52 that allowed a creator to tell an entire story the way they wanted to tell it without what seems to be any editorial interference.
Yeah. Now, do you think that came from Azzarello's reputation? Because he had written things in the past that put him in the forefront of creators at the time. Or do you think that Wonder Woman at the time was not a huge seller? And maybe he was given this title and no one was really paying attention.
Well, it's a little bit of both. I mean, I think that, yes, Wonder Woman was not a great seller for a variety of reasons that aren't applicable to this discussion. But Brian Azzarello, I think at that point, would have been considered, and I think he still is in some ways, a superstar creator.
Oh, yeah.
And So you put a superstar creator in charge of one of the, what would be considered one of the big three, like in terms of the property that exists within DC. I mean, there's a reason they're called the Trinity, and there's a reason it's Superman, Batman, and then Wonder Woman.
Yes, I agree with that. But it's the same thing.
Editorial had to be paying attention. They had to have known when they were handing over like one of the big three properties to a superstar writer, there had to be attention paid.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't think they just left him alone.
Did they feel that the story that he proposed, because he obviously had proposed, you know, he had done a, you know, a proposal for this and they allowed it to go forward. You know, they had to have been paying attention, but there was enough, somebody in editorial said, hey, there's a really good story being told here. Let's keep events out of it. Let's keep editorial interference out of this. Let's keep continuity out of this and let this story be told.
Well, the one good thing about the New 52 was the fact that you basically could start over. You know, there are those who don't like to call New 52 a reboot, but that's exactly what it was.
Yes.
You know, it was just, you know, start year one, everyone begin again. You know, that does allow, if the creator has a plan, and is allowed to follow that plan, that allows for a lot of creativity and a lot of really good storytelling is what you get here.
And this series is a strange anomaly within like that whole within the whole New 52. From the way it looks to the storytelling itself, it's so removed from the way the rest of the universe was being treated.
Yes, absolutely. And I just think that needs to happen more and more often. Marvel could take a lesson from that. First of all, like you said earlier, and this is actually becoming a running theme on the show, I think, just stop with the crossovers. Can we just build a storyline without having to have it interrupted? Because if you don't interrupt the storyline, look at this. This is Ezra, not just these first six issues of what we're talking about, but his entire 34-issue run tells a complete story arc from beginning to end with enough wiggle room so that a new creator can come on and continue.
Right. And as it turned out, yeah, and as it turned out, this story is not canon anymore. I mean, it's been removed from canon. It may never have been canon to begin with. And that's fine, because what we have is a 34-issue or run of a really intriguing story that doesn't owe anything to anything that came before or anything that came after. It is a very unique take on Wonder Woman, and it stands, I think, on its own as something that I think people can read and really enjoy without having to feel bound by the history and the future.
Yes, I agree with that 100%. And, you know, it took a lot of chances by telling the story in this fashion, and it succeeded more often than it failed. So, yeah, because there are a couple of... now, I think we're getting far afield because both of us have read the entire series. So we know what's going to come after these first six issues. But, you know, he falls down a couple of times. I don't think that the inclusion of the New Gods was good for the story. You can disagree with that.
Oh, well, this is...
Yeah, we can roll this back.
So, yeah, let's cut that. Yeah, because I have some feelings about the New Gods and their inclusion, but it's because it's been a while since I've read it. I can't.
Yeah, you can't speak to it.
I know you, especially bringing in, what's his face?
Orion.
Yeah, Orion, who is a dickhead anyway. But
yeah, a sexist ass.
a known dickhead throughout the entire history of the New Gods.
Yes. All right, so forgive me if I don't know my Greek mythology as well as I think I do. But is Strife...
I think you know it better than I do.
No. Is Strife an actual god, or is this... Azzarello's creation.
I have no idea.
Right. I think the addition of Strife is a brilliant move, because it's literally adding Strife to the storyline, and she acts as a motivator in one way or another to push the story along.
Well, that horrible scene where her appearance on the island, on Paradise Island, causes the Amazons to start killing each other.
Yeah, that's
that's a terrible scene.
Yes, it is. And they sort of brush it off pretty quickly.
The scene itself is actually not that long, and you're really not sure what's happening. I mean, you get, by the end of the scene, you realize what has been happening, but you don't realize exactly the nature of what has been done to them until the next issue, basically, mm-hmm. where, you know, they're having the memorial and the Amazons themselves are devastated, absolutely devastated by this. They feel as if there has been that they have been compromised as a people because of this.
Yes, she does. But also there's an aspect of that where, because they're so intrinsically tied to this pantheon, they sort of take it in stride that the gods do this from time to time. It's very it's a quick scene, but it's very complex in how it's told.
Well, and it leads to the dissension in the ranks.
Yes.
It leads to the distrust of Diana. It leads to the distrust of Hippolyta. It leads to sort of a breakdown in not just morale, but even in respect for authority. Not that there's anything wrong with disrespect for authority, but it leads to questioning everything that they have stood for, and they are also questioning even Hippolyta's ability to rule them.
It's almost as if strife was added into there.
Exactly.
Diana's little temper tantrum is pretty impressive in that next issue, where she just smashes trees down.
Well, yes. Her whole world has been
destroyed
in front of her. Everything she's known, it's not a temper tantrum. It's anger. It's righteous anger, almost.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. I described it poorly.
I mean, it is everything she has known, like the revelation. So what we're basically talking about is the revelation that she has just been given by Hippolyta, that she is not the daughter of clay, but the daughter of Zeus and Hippolyta. So again, to go back to her entire world had been built on the fact that she was built out of clay and that she was of no man born. And she has found out that that is not true. And she is reacting in probably a way that we're lucky the trees are taking the brunt of her anger and not humans or her fellow Amazons.
That's true. And it does, and that scene directly after that, where she takes the torch and actually
the shame is mine, she says, the shame is mine.
Yes, and she actually blows the flame into the pyres and sets them alight. Right. It's really, it shows her leadership, it shows her strength, mm-hmm. but it also shows her anger and vulnerability. It
shows her weakness is that she takes the shame onto herself in a way that is inappropriate, because the shame is not hers. She is the one that should least have shame. The shame belongs to everybody who knew and covered it up. But her strength is, her weakness and her strength at the same time, is that she takes the shame upon herself. It's a very brutal moment and a very telling moment.
Yeah, it's incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
And it gets back to that economy of story. It's just a few pages.
Right.
But with the minimalist way that he tells the story and the art surrounding it, it's really incredibly well done. It's very moving. And yet she still has that power and authority. It's stunning.
She has the authority. She knows enough about herself to know she has the authority to take the shame onto herself. She is not allowing someone to put it upon her. She is taking it upon herself.
Yes. And she is, and this is something that happens throughout the series, but especially in this first six issues, is she's learning as it goes along. She's learning her abilities. She's learning more about who she is, literally and figuratively.
Right.
Yeah. It's quite great. I mean, we start with this origin story, but she's growing as a hero as we, you know, as the story goes along. Okay. So she leaves the island, and while she's gone, Hera comes. Hera, I find to be a very, at least in this part of the story, Hera does continue throughout this run, but in this story, she's difficult. Well, difficult in the problem, in the sense that she's taking the anger she has towards her husband out on the people that her husband has transgressed with.
Sure, but what other options does she have? I mean, Hera's a terrible human being, or a terrible human. She's not a human being.
terrible creature.
She's a terrible god in some ways, in that we are made known that she has killed children that have been sired by her husband.
Yes, and she goes on to kill, basically, well, she
destroys Paradise Island.
Yes, and she alters, you know, she turns all the Amazons into snakes.
But there's that telling scene when she does that, when Hippolyta has knelt and asked for forgiveness. And Hera holds her, and she says, I wish I could. And we don't see what happens after that until like a few panels, many panels later. But it's almost like she is trapped within this cycle of violence
and abuse.
And she is reacting in the only way she knows how.
Yes, and I know that she's not supposed to be a sympathetic character, at least not yet.
Not yet.
I found her actions to be extreme, let's say that. Now, I realize we're talking about the Queen of the Gods and so forth. And yes, I guess everything's supposed to be extreme.
I mean, her husband is a dick.
Yeah.
Like, the ultimate dick. You know,
was that supposed to be a pun?
That wasn't. But, you know, well, he does have the power of lightning. But how many centuries? There's no timeline attached to this. I mean, but we assume the mythology of the Greek gods goes back thousands of years. This is clearly set in modern times. How do the gods react to time, the movement of time, what have you? These are all existential questions that aren't addressed in the comics at all. I'm saying them now just myself. But, you know, we are given partial context. The life, if life can be applied to gods, that Hera has lived.
Yeah,
and I understand that in these six issues, we do not have a sense of sympathy for her, except for that scene where she says, "I wish I could."
I don't know why that bothers me so much. It does. As I was reading it, I don't know. Her motivations seem contrived, if you know what I mean. We need
the jealous wife, like going after
the
woman or the children who have slept with
right their husband. Well, we need a reason for Zola to be in danger.
It's a legitimate reason if Hera's whole shtick
is baby killing,
right? Because it's also about power. Because the more children of Zeus that are out there, the more her power is distilled.
Yeah, you're right about that.
And her legitimate, quote-unquote, legitimate children, sorry to do the quote-unquote, what she would feel are her legitimate children, then are also compromised, because when it comes to ruling in Olympus...
Yeah, you don't want
Olympus. You know, the line of succession. Right. Succession.
Yeah, and you don't want bastards usurping the throne.
Right. You don't want Lennox making the claim to the throne over Apollo.
Exactly. Well, that's a good transition to get into Lennox. An interesting character, you know, not a lot of introduction to him. He just sort of enters the story. We get a quick backstory. He's been alive for a long time. And then he just enters in. A really just interesting, compelling character, just out of the blue, basically.
Sure.
Let's talk about Zola.
Okay, let's talk about Zola.
I love the fact that, you know, the common trope in this situation would be, like in Greek mythology, she would be seduced by the gods and would have no authority. She would be a passive person in the story.
Right.
Zola, on the other hand, turns that out of its head. Not only did she willingly do this, she's not really even sure which one was Zeus, which I thought was interesting. Hey, might have been the trucker. I don't know. So she is very much in control of herself. Very much
the badass who controls her own body.
Exactly. Exactly. And I like the fact that she did that. Yes. Now she does have people trying to kill her, but she still fights back. She still tries to, you know,
it's not her fault people are trying to kill her.
Yes. Her very first, when she first meets Diana, Wonder Woman wants to, you know, give me the key and you stay here and I'll go on and fix this. And she says, no, that's not going to happen. I'm going to be a part of this.
Right.
Yeah. So I love the fact that she's, you know, a common woman, but she's a strong badass as well.
And by common woman, you mean like a earthbound human.
Earthbound
human woman.
Yeah. Don't take that in the wrong connotation. Right. There.
Who basically, she's an earthbound woman who
she's a human
about to take shit from some gods.
Yes. She's a human in the middle of a bunch of bickering gods. And and like you said, she's not going to take shit from anyone. And, you know, she knows what she wants and she's going to fight to get it. I am impressed with Zola as a character.
And she's not afraid even to call Wonder Woman out. She calls Wonder Woman out on some of the bullshit as well. It's like she's not afraid. It's a very interesting character because she's not afraid of that which is unknown, which she's been thrown into the middle of. And her instincts are immediately to forge her way into this and to make herself as important as everybody else on the playing field.
Yes, exactly. And she basically says, I'm not your pawn.
Right.
You know, I am an active participant in this situation.
I mean, how many times did Wonder Woman tell her to do one thing and she did the other?
And actually,
several times in this 6-issue run that Zola just says, oh, hell no.
Exactly. You know? It actually becomes a running joke to, you know, how didn't I tell you to stay back there?
She is a very interesting character that I feel is really more strongly developed going forward. But I think the seeds are planted here. That's not the word I wanted, the phrase I wanted to use. I think...
Was that a pregnant pause?
Yeah. I think as a plot device, what they're doing with her is really establishing her in a way that becomes very important later. But we start to see the beginning of who she is to become, and which is also pretty amazing.
Yes, and Azzarello is able to do that in these 6 issues. There's a lot of characters, you know, as much as we've said that, you know, these are quick reads and it goes through, but he's introducing a boatload of characters, a pantheon, if you will.
Right.
And a lot of them are new that we don't know about. Like, we can fill in the gaps with the Greek gods. We have a basic understanding of those. And all Azzarello needs to do is put a couple of character traits on each one. But we're getting brand new characters with Zola, with Lennox, even with Hermes, because he becomes his own character as well.
Azzarello is taking all of these archetypes and he is presenting them in a way that is new. It's interesting. It shares the history, but he's creating them as characters that are uniquely fresh almost.
Yes.
And part of that is the presentation that, like, Akins and Chang did in terms of their art, but we see them all as unique things as opposed to just generic archetypes. I mean, two of my favorite characters that he's introduced in, like, the last couple issues are Hades and Poseidon. These are great characters, and there are some great characters soon to come that aren't covered in these issues.
Mm-hmm.
But Poseidon as a big, giant, monstrous fish.
Yes, like, and that's just brilliant, I think. You know, he's
with carbuncles on him and all kinds of nastiness around him, but he's also very personable. And Hades, who is a child.
With candles on his
with
head.
With candles and wax dripping into his... He has no eyes.
Yes.
He has no face.
Well, and the fact that the candles on his head with the smoke going around, when he's shown from a distance, it looks like there's a mushroom cloud over his head.
Right. Which is very intentional again.
Yes. So very, very unique. This gets back to the arc, the very unique character design that that plays so well in these stories. It makes perfect sense. It's unexpected, but it makes perfect sense when you see it. You know, when you first see Poseidon raised from the ocean at this giant fish, my first thought was, is he going to stay that way the whole time? And then when he does, it just, yeah, of course he is.
It's just perfect because, of course, that's what he looks like.
Yes.
And whether that is human perception of what he looks like, same with Hades, same with Hermes, same with all of the characters, that is never answered, but you have to allow yourself to think about that. We should also clarify that Hades and Poseidon are the brothers of Zeus.
Right.
And Hermes and many of these other characters are the sons of Zeus. So it should be clarified that Poseidon and Hades are the legitimate heirs to Olympus if Zeus is truly gone, which is where all this comes into play.
So do you want to talk a little bit about that closing gambit that they do?
Sure.
Because it is a bit confusing. We've actually talked about this off mic a bit of what exactly happens at the end. So the end of the issues, I think this is the only, if there's a criticism to be had, I think it's this bit at the end. The plan that Lennox comes up with is not exactly explained in great detail.
So the plan, what is the plan?
The plan was...
Tell us the plan, Paul.
The plan was, overall, to place a binding spell on Hera so that she's bound to Wonder Woman and can't do any harm to Zola. In order to do that, they needed...
So this is once they've put all of the characters sort of
Once the characters are all in place.
All in place. We've had like five and a half issues of action. We've had 5.5 issues of setting things up.
Meeting all the characters, getting everyone in place.
Right.
And so in order to get Zola out of harm's way, they got to place a binding spell on Hera. Now, in order to do this, they need a candle from Hades. In order to get Hades to come out of get Hades out of Hades, we've discussed this. He's the only man who actually names the place he lives after himself. It's the equivalent of Brian living in Brian.
Or Paul living in Paul.
Exactly. So in order to get him to come out of the underworld, they need to have the pretense of doing a deal with Poseidon.
They have to lure him out.
So they have to lure Poseidon to the gates of hell, basically. So that works as well as one can imagine.
So we have Poseidon and Hades meeting up with the rest of the cast of characters.
Yes. Dealing Hera's brideship as if it was just a commodity. You know, the Greek gods are assholes.
Pretty much.
Yeah. So while all that's going on and they're all distracted by their petty bickering, then they put their plan in place. Lennox steals the candle.
Well, to clarify the plan, plan is what they have done to lure Hades and Poseidon together is to offer them rule of Olympus.
Yeah. Dual rule.
Dual rule. With Hades ruling the night, ruling the day, and sharing Hera as a wife.
You know, like you do.
As one guy.
Yes.
This is Trump's America. Anything is possible.
That was your political corner for the day.
Thank you.
All day. And all of that works, and they're able to place the spell on Hera, and Zola is safe for a few minutes. None of that's really explained all that well.
No, I was, to be honest, I read this when it came out and I reread it again for this podcast. And I still, like, I think I read it 3 times and still couldn't figure out what the hell actually happened.
Yes. And you had called me before we started recording to say what happened. And I said, I just sort of stumbled around going, well, I think what happened was, we went through this piece by piece. And that's the thing. That's the only criticism or the real falling down in the story that I can give to this, which is it all happens quite quickly at the end. It makes sense if you really pick it apart.
It's poorly explained in the comic.
Yes. It could have used a little bit, just a dialogue box here and there, just to explain what they're doing. Other than that, though, I found this to be incredibly compelling story. I was riveted all the way through. So much so that I just continued on and read the entire run. What are your thoughts of this first 6 issues?
Well, I think it's an incredible point of storytelling, and I think that it sets up, like, what it sets up is pretty amazing as you go forward.
Yes.
You have sort of the classic gods versus human, and human is basically only displayed in Zola. That's the only human, the non-god, that is involved in all of this. Every other working character is a god. So you have the machinations of the gods trying to mess with the lives of humans.
Yeah, that's true. Even Wonder Woman herself is, you know, divine.
Is right. Yeah. She's a demigod.
Yeah.
And so Zola stands as the only piece of humanity that we see in this entire 6-issue run. We get some more of that going forward, but in the six issue run, we basically are, it's court procedure, you know, and court intrigue.
Yes, exactly.
Actually, the entire 6-issue run is court intrigue. I mean, it's almost Shakespearean.
Oh yeah.
If I can be allowed to compare Azarello to Shakespeare, I'm sure Azarello would not wish to be compared to Shakespeare. It is almost that level of sort of import and intrigue being slowly plugged into what is a long-running story.
Yes, and I do like the fact that, talking about war, how war is usually portrayed in Wonder Woman comics in particular as the great adversary.
Right.
Yes, especially even in the movie, Ares is the adversary.
Right.
But in this one, he's more of a mentor, you know, to Wonder Woman, which is an interesting take on that as well.
He has his own agenda. He has his own agenda.
But that doesn't play in very much with the great grand scheme, that all the gods themselves are petty.
Yes.
And everybody has their own little self-centered motivations.
And they're so very, very, very human.
Yes, very much. I found this all very compelling. And the fact that Wonder Woman is sort of the conduit through which we see all of these things take place, and her learning along the way of what is most important to her. Now, she could become part of this pantheon. In fact, she's she is part of it, but she chooses to remain as the protector of the human, basically asserting her heroic side. You know, that in and of itself is compelling. She distances herself from her own godhood.
She's embracing power while also rejecting the origin of power.
Yes, she becomes more powerful by retaining her human side.
By striking her down, she only becomes more powerful. Huh? So I think ultimately, while the story has its detractors, and I think that those detractors are legitimate in their concerns, for me, taking this as just a story in and of itself, I think that Brian Azzarello has done a great job of creating a world, creating unique characters, and creating unique conundrums for them to face. And I think it's done in... No one is ever contesting Brian Azzarello's ability to write, plot, or dialogue. I think that thematically, he is creating a very interesting world, and I think that it is interesting to follow that to its end, which is a very finite 34-issue end. And I think that these 6 issues really lay out a great start to the story that he wants to tell. Whether that story works for everyone, it's hard to tell. That's okay. But for me, as a fan of storytelling, this is one of the great runs that I have read in recent times, and I highly recommend this series, actually.
There's not much more I can add to that. That was, just basically perfect and summed up my feelings as well. The only thing I can think of to add is the fact that, Wonder Woman is not a character that I've said before, that not a character that I've read much. I mean, I know by reputation and, and the iconic status of Wonder Woman. But having read this series, it makes me want to go and read more. So, if nothing else, I'm going to be reading a lot of Wonder Woman in the future, and a lot of it is in part based on how much I enjoyed this particular run by Azzarello.
And I would recommend the George Perez run.
Perhaps that will be another collected edition. But speaking of another collected edition, Brian...
Yes.
You have a recommendation for our next episode.
Yes. I am recommending the first 11 issues of Scalp, the Vertigo series by the now famous Jason Aaron and R.M. Guerrera. Not much I want to say about it at this point. It's a pretty impressive series. So that is our next, that's my recommendation, Scalped by Jason Aaron and R.M. Guerrera, the first 11 issues.
That's fantastic. That is actually a great run. And I look forward to revisiting that for our next episode. So I think that's it for today. Until next time.
Thank you for stopping by, folks.
Yes. Keep reading comics. We'll talk to you next time.
Be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. The show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes. You can also send us feedback at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or on Twitter at the Daddy Elk Productions handle @DaddyElk and use the hashtag Collected Edition. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained?
And it's the same thing.
I think there's another one already, like, in pre-production.
And that's because Michael Bay likes to jack himself off. Sorry. I'm going to cut that out.
Kids, ask your parents what that means.
No, he
tell
he,
them Paul Carr sent you.
He likes to masturbate all over American flags and explosions. So. I'm not a fan of Michael Bay. Can you tell?